Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. I have to tell you a quick story by way of our interest in the work of our guest today. And for me, this quest of understanding started when I heard the story of a Native American who fell through the ice in a pond and didn't have help or couldn't get to help for quite some time. And the story goes that he just decided to relax and let his mind expand into the world around him, this snowy landscape. And he went into a deep sleep. And I think it was many, many hours later, long after someone would normally thought to survive in a cold, freezing pond, he was rescued and revived. And I thought, you know, that's just such a beautiful story. Because our physiology is so astounding and nature is so dazzling in the mechanisms that she can come up with. And there are creatures who do that, who just relax into winter, the bear in hibernation, the turtles that sit in mud at the end, at the bottom of an icy pond and relax into nature and survive. Can a human do it? I don't know. It sounds like it might be possible. There are physiological miracles to be had here. I wanted to talk with Bernd Heinrich, who has explored this in detail, how animals survive the depths of oxygen deprivation, food deprivation, and cold in winter. He's a biologist at the University of Vermont, grew up in Maine, and goes to Maine yearly to go to the laboratory of the winter woods to see just what the animals are doing. He has written Winter World, The Ingenuity of Animal Survival, and we're pleased to talk with him here today. Bernd, welcome, and thank you so much for all the wonderful work that you do. I'm not out there tramping in the woods in the winter, but I'm so glad that you are to bring back the stories of how nature survives out there in these extreme conditions. You know, I can hardly hear you. I hope we have a good phone connection.
Okay, is this better?
Much better, thanks.
Okay.
Well, tell me a little bit about growing up in Maine and how you made this your life's work, understanding the natural world around you.
Well, growing up in Maine is, you know, to be close to nature all the time. And, you know, since I was a little kid, nature has been my entertainment, so to speak. And because there's so many fascinating things happening all the time, and, you know, I was out in the woods all the time and watching animals. And, you know, I later studied at the University of Maine. I was, first of all, a zoology major. And then for my PhD, I went to UCLA and studied physiological ecology. And that's where we examine the different adaptations of animals to the physical environment. And and since I was out in the winter a lot, and the cold is definitely a, you know, a potential stressor that can kill animals. And as you mentioned, the person falling through the ice, turtles, you know, routinely surviving, you know, 6 months or more under the ice. You know, there's such interesting puzzles there that that certainly there is enough there for lifetime's work of many, many people. And I can't really just talk about my own work. I have to talk mostly about the work of others. But, you know, I started out from insects and went out from there.
such an interesting puzzle, isn't it? Because we think, oh, food and water and oxygen and all of that that's so necessary for our metabolic processes, how do these animals go for months on end without that?
Yes, well, you know, as I said, I started with insects, and for example, our body, we require that we maintain a high body temperature all the time to be active. But, you know, there's some insects that can be active at very, very low body temperatures. There are even some moths who can fly with a temperature, body temperature near 0 degrees, and there are others that fly with a body temperature that's much higher than ours.
Is it a simple adaptation to their physiology, or does their body go through a whole different chemistry to, you know, get the enzymes? I know that our enzymes need to be at a certain temperature to function,
right?
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the whole thing just sort of goes flat here.
So the thing is, there are so many things happening all together, and there are different solutions. For example, with respect to activity, one way is to maintain activity despite the temperature, or another means is to tune out, so to speak, and do something else, and become totally inactive, and physiologically, and their behavioral options, they have morphological options, such as some moths can fly with by evolving much larger wings, where they sail a little bit more, and so their flight motor doesn't have to run at quite so high speed, such as high octane fuel consumption. So in fact, some of them that don't have any food can actually store food from the larval stage. So, you know, there's so many different options that can be pulled in all different directions.
And bees, for a long time scientists thought, how do bees even fly? And you've done an in-depth study on bees too, haven't you?
Yes, after I did my studies on moths, and basically at first I was working with sphinx moths, which are basically tropical animals, and then I came here to Vermont and started working on different species of moths that fly in the winter, some of them with a high body temperature and some with a low. And then I, you know, worked with bees for a long time, and there you have the social situation, social thermoregulation.
Thermoregulation. So together they generate enough heat?
Yeah, they can cluster. And, you know, it's the same principle as in Alaska, you know, you huddle up to your dog at night.
Your three-dog night,
Three-dog night. So, you know, bees, they have a 20,000 body night.
They beat those wings. They can generate some friction, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, actually, they don't generate friction. They use their wing muscles, but their wings don't move at all. So if you just looked at them, you wouldn't see any wing movement at all.
Yeah,
and so they can basically kind of keep their flight motor going mechanically, actually, inside without, so to speak, spinning their wheels like a car motor.
That would be wasteful of energy, wouldn't it?
Well, but the thing is, it produces heat. So in one sense, just producing heat and no mechanical action is totally wasteful. On the other hand, if you're wanting to produce heat, it's not wasteful. So it depends on what your aims are.
Well, I understand the reasons that humans shiver when we're cold is because why? What's that physiological impulse?
Well, it's working the muscles. You know, whether the work muscles are being used for locomotion, they're contracting and they're producing a lot of heat. And then shivering is just that you have, let's say, opposing muscles working at the same time. And but they're not they're contracting the same way as locomotion, only they're not being harnessed for locomotion. They're just producing the heat as a byproduct of the contraction. So you know,
nature has a lot of solutions up her sleeves, doesn't she?
Incredible, yeah. And so the thing is that many animals have sort of incipient tendencies to be able to harness different solutions. You know, for example, we can't stay under the ice for 6 months, but, you know, we can stay under, we can be submerged for more than usual time if we allow our body temperature to drop.
So that story is quite feasible, that
sure.
the Native American just relaxed and let
right.
his body temperature drop and it didn't do him any harm.
Right.
He didn't suffer hypothermia. Tell
right.
me about
well,
that.
Well, he did have hypothermia. That's what
yeah.
saved him. If he didn't have hypothermia, he'd be dead. That's what saves him.
Explain that one, if
you would. That's the solution.
Wow.
Well, even surgeons will, you know, cool down the brain if they're going to operate.
Because it stops the blood flow?
Yeah, it stops the Well, the blood flow can be stopped when it's cold.
Mm-hmm. But at least they slow it down so you're not bleeding so much when they're cutting you open, right?
The thing is, when your blood flow is stopped, mm-hmm. Then you're not getting fuel and waste, fuel delivered and waste taken away. So you've got to... cut down your metabolism, and one way to cut down the metabolism is to become cold.
Gotcha.
So the going on ice, so to speak, or cooling the body temperature, results that the cells don't run out of fuel and mm-hmm. starve, mm-hmm. and the waste don't build up. So
you know,
what happens is if you so potentially this person who fell through the ice didn't struggle, just let himself be cooled, mm-hmm. which is what would happen normally, he was, first of all, he was saving all that energy, right?
Right, yeah.
And so the fuel reserves were maintained, and he didn't suffer harm. And this is what, you know, a turtle going under the ice has a very, very low metabolic rate, an extremely low metabolic rate. And that's because it is cold. If it should warm up, it would die. So the only reason it survived, it has to be in a cold place.
Boy, isn't that fantastic. Interesting. I'm surprised that NASA isn't, like, into this kind of research. Maybe they are, because if we're ever going to send people, you know, to Mars or something, they're going to have to endure a whole lot of time in the deep freeze of space. And also you wonder the cryogenic people, which I don't really think is a viable solution to make yourself live forever.
Right.
But, you know, they have the problem of the cells freezing and then exploding or tearing up when they thaw people out or tissue out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the unviable aspects to freezing your tissue is the damage it undergoes when you're trying to thaw it. So how do turtles and insects and all these other creatures, does their tissue doesn't freeze solid, of course, but what kind of damage or frostbite, you know, those people who are caught out, who don't relax into the snow,
right.
And their toes drop off because of frostbite. How does tissue survive getting so cold and freezing?
Well, first of all, there are many animals that do survive freezing, actual tissue freezing.
Antifreeze in their cells of some sort. Then.
Well, that's just antifreeze is just to prevent freezing. So one solution is to prevent freezing, having antifreeze. So in other words, you prevent ice crystal formation by having antifreeze.
Which is what some salmon in the Arctic waters do, right? That's why their oil is so desirable. They have some sort of omega-3s or something that prevents.
Well, it might be just to be able to operate at low mm-hmm. at low temperatures.
Okay.
But you know there are many Arctic Antarctic fish, for example, they have their body temperature below the freezing point of the normal freezing point of the water because it's less than 0 degrees, and they're rather dilute in their solute concentrations, and they could potentially freeze solid at those temperatures.
My.
However, they prevent them, and that would kill them. However, mm-hmm. they prevent themselves by having antifreeze proteins in the blood.
Wow.
And so they don't freeze solid. On the other hand, sometimes, for example, wood frogs and spring peepers and tree frogs and quite a number of insects regularly freeze solid. And there, they have proteins in the blood that specifically act like nucleating agents to promote freezing. And they survive by being frozen.
What is their unthawing process like, and why don't the ice crystals kind of burst the, you know, because well, ice expands as it freezes, right?
Yeah, as it freezes, but, you know, once it melts, it's no problem. But once it freezes, so first of all, the ice crystals have to be small, and they have to be in places in the body where they do less damage. For example, most of these survive by having the ice crystals outside the cells, extracellularly. So where they would do less damage to tearing membranes and intracellular structures. So then after the ice crystals form, the cells kind of become dehydrated, and so there's less ice formation inside the cells, and the ice crystals are smaller and are less damaging.
So clever.
So the rate of freezing and that allows for dehydration inside the cells is important, and so there are special mechanisms involved in the way the freezing occurs.
Boy.
That allows some organisms to survive freezing.
Hmm.
And, you know, embryos of livestock, for example, are regularly frozen, and even human embryos have been frozen and kept on ice for years.
That's true.
And they're still viable.
Now, do you ever wonder, do you ever doubt the theory of evolution if so many different species have come up with the same solutions to similar problems? That there, you know, that there's just these codes within our genes that can be activated, or how these solutions get distributed across various species, from insect to reptiles to mammals to the whole bit? Is it not to, that you doubt evolution, but do you have a new kind of theory as to how, you know, these same mechanisms keep arriving time after time after time?
Well, that's the way evolution works. It's very conservative. You have the same, they have the solutions at work. And it's just an elaboration from simple beginnings to more and more complex. So it makes me even more convinced of the beauty of evolution, because I see the processes now. I see how in one animal this works a little bit, and the other one's gone one step further, and the other one another step further, and they have evolved in strictly in line with what you would predict from physical and biochemical processes, and taken advantage of them. And you can't do magic. It's you can only elaborate on processes that are available, and these different organisms avail themselves of the same mechanisms, because but, you know, they end up often very different because they face different constraints and different possibilities.
Each environment offers its own different parameters.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. The beauty of nature. That must be the fun part of your job, just the awe-inspiring moments of coming face to face with this intelligent aspect to nature.
Well, it certainly makes organisms so much more fascinating to try to fathom, and these different mechanisms that are going on that take lifetimes to unravel.
And millions of years to design in the first place.
That's right. So you're seeing what has not something that's just, you know, designed in 7 days, but something that's taken millions of years to design. And it all makes sense. That's the beauty of it.
It all makes sense. Yeah. I've often wondered how the bears do it. They lay on these fat stores, and then they dig themselves a nice den. I guess you go deep in the earth and the temperature stays the same, and they curl up and they go to sleep. Tell us what other animals do the hibernation thing, and is it just a matter of, you know, slowing down their metabolism as well, and, you know, their body just goes to those fat stores to run their metabolism at it normally, but at just a lower rate? Or what are their secrets?
Again, there are many things going on simultaneously, and bears hibernate in very different ways. And for example, an Arctic ground squirrel, for example, First of all, an Arctic ground squirrel will drop its body temperature down to the freezing point of water and below. So it's essentially almost ice, just shy of being ice. And it apparently has an alarm reaction, so if it should potentially freeze, you know, into a block of ice when it gets that cold, it can rouse itself and prevent that. So they're very close to the edge as far as freezing is concerned.
And this internal sensor device is fascinating too, but go ahead.
Right. Yeah, but bears, on the other hand, you know, they regulate a much higher body temperature, actually
closer. Bigger mass, don't they?
They have, so that's because of their larger mass, yeah. I mean, if you're a really large animal, first of all, you're going to be heating and cooling much, much slower. And so you can't quickly arouse, even if you wanted to. And suppose danger threatened, if you're a big animal, you can't hide so well, and you can't arouse so well, and so you could potentially be eaten. So it's very dangerous for a huge animal to cool itself down that far. And anyway, so that means that they're going to, in order to keep warm, they're going to have, the metabolism has to keep going to maintain that body temperature.
I see.
So that means they have to have more fuel, which means that they have to be fatter to store up more fuel. Or if you, in the case of a chipmunk, for example, they will store food, not in the terms of fat, but in, you know, fat stores and granaries in the den.
And even their cheeks, you found out, can hold 60 seeds each, so they can go put their little stores away.
Well, I don't remember. I did count them.
Yeah, I read that, 60 seeds each.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So again, that's related to their winter survival, so that they can gather seeds more quickly and bring them into the den. So it's all related to the overall strategy of winter survival. And red squirrels and gray squirrels, for example, don't survive the winter by storing underground seeds. So they don't have that mechanism, that you know, details of body structure that's involved in their behavior.
Yep.
And but anyways, you were talking about
the
overwintering of the bears. So they. Maintaining high body temperature and metabolic rate has then implications to other aspects of the biology. For example, if we were to maintain a high body temperature and active, we would have waste products accumulating in the blood, and we'd have to eliminate them, and to eliminate them, we would have to flush them out with water, we'd have to drink, we'd have to urinate. And a bear doesn't drink or urinate all winter long. And again, that involves then biochemistry. What happens here is that they reduce the amount of uric acid, which normally accumulates in vertebrates, in mammals, from protein metabolism. First of all, they reduce the amount of protein metabolism by burning fat, which means less uric acid. And what uric acid is produced, it's recycled into a non-toxic product and then gets recycled back into muscle, so it doesn't have to be eliminated, so they don't have to eliminate water.
Do they have a special organ that does that, or is it just some couple of enzymes in their liver? Or I mean, how do they manage that?
Well, it involves special enzymes, that's right, and I believe they're in the liver, mostly. Yeah. And
so they just have little added extra mechanisms to do that. Wow.
Right. So, but then, you know, if you're forced to rely on fat metabolism all this time, we would probably get hardening of the arteries. And they have some mechanisms, again, some probably biochemical tricks to reduce or prevent that.
Well, see, that could be useful if we could learn what the bears are doing.
Right.
That could apply to human coronary disease risk. Who knows?
Right. Yeah, not only that, but also, you know, muscle degeneration. They have no muscle degeneration.
Oh, because if we sat around all winter long and didn't move a muscle, our muscles would atrophy, wouldn't they?
They would atrophy, and bones as well.
So how do they prevent that? How do the bears manage?
Well, again, they're special biochemical mechanisms. I can't I don't know, you know, the precise steps. I'm not a biochemist to tell you all the steps that are involved in reducing the osteoporosis. I mean, I'm sure that...
But somehow they're managing to pull that off.
Wow. But there are riddles there, and there being there are people working on these because they have great interest to medicine.
There are. Even the, I've heard that husky dogs, how do they run for such a long time mm-hmm. when they're pulling sleds and doing their work? They have extra oxygen in their blood to do that. They have so their blood is super oxygenated to keep them sustained. It's just wonderful stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, beaver and muskrat, for example, in the wintertime also have can carry more oxygen in the blood because they have to dive underwater
and
in order to
brain.
Get the food stores.
Wow.
So, you know, under that stress. But, you know, we have the same tendencies. You know, athletes carry more oxygen in the blood in part.
Because the body's adapting to what the athletes are asking their bodies to do, the demand that they're placing on it. So,
right. Yeah. So if we have more and more demands, and if there's mortality, a lot of mortality on those who don't, mm-hmm. Then you get natural selection in that direction.
Interesting. The turtles you've discovered get their oxygen in another ingenious method, those that stay at the bottom of those frozen ponds. Tell us about that.
Well, turtles are air-breathing reptiles, and they have lungs, and that's they use their lungs, of course, when they need to have a lot of oxygen. But when they're in the bottom of the pond and the pond water gets too close to freezing, then, you know, metabolism just chugs along at a very, very slow rate, and so they can get by with very little oxygen. And that little that they need, they can absorb through the skin, and that suffices. And especially in the rectum, the skin is especially thin, and that's where they can absorb sufficient oxygen.
From the plant matter that's out there and the bottom of the pond, photosynthesizing.
Well, yeah,
yeah.
Well, that's where ultimately a lot of the oxygen would come into. But, you know, of course, there's also oxygen coming through the surface. But, of course, with the ice, there would be less. So,
well, water's, two-thirds oxygen. So I don't know if they can take it direct from water. It has to be kind of liberated oxygen.
Yeah, well, it has to be free oxygen. It can't be part of the water as such. It has to be free, dissolved oxygen. But again, snapping turtles, for example, they burrow into the mud where bacteria would basically remove the oxygen, make it anoxic, so, as they say. And there's very, very little oxygen. And they
tell us about that when we come back. We're talking with Bernd Heinrich. He's written a number of books, all based on his observations and studies into the natural world. This is Winter World, the Ingenuity of Animal Survival, that details how animals survive the extremes of winter. We'll be right back. I'm Laura Lee. Let's get back to our conversation with Bernd Heinrich. His book, Winter World, the Ingenuity of Animal Survival, looks at the various solutions and biochemical mechanisms that nature has come up with to allow reptiles, insects, mammals, birds, all sorts of animals to survive the extremes of winter. And Bernd, you're about to tell us about the snapping turtles, I think, hibernating in the bottom of those frozen ponds.
Right. So, again, it's not just biochemistry, it's physiology, and a lot of it is behavior that's important here. And the snapping turtles are really amazing, I think, because they choose to overwinter in mud, which is basically oxygen-free. So they spend the winter without oxygen. And in part, it's thought that they burrow into the mud for safety because they're in shallow ponds and could potentially be dug up by raccoons in the spring and so on. But so they go into what we call an oxygen debt during the winter. Their metabolism shuts down so low that they need very, very little, but the metabolism still keeps going. So they're essentially doing what we do, let's say, on a sprint where we use up more oxygen than we have, and so we accumulate an oxygen debt and have to, so our blood becomes acid due to lactic acid, and that we have to inspire more oxygen later to reduce that lactic acid. And
that's
so,
why you're panting at the end of the sprint.
Panting at the end. So that's basically what the turtle does at the end of the winter.
He comes up and pants?
Well, he would breathe a lot more oxygen than he normally would during that time. And so for a time he has to, he's putting
oxygen stores in his system.
Putting oxygen back into the system, and he's basically inactive. He's sort of like a sprinter. At the end of the run, he's exhausted because he's out of oxygen.
Wow. Oh, how interesting. They also, some animals also accumulate vitamin C. Now, this is fascinating to me because we need to ingest our vitamin C from foods or supplements, and animals can make it in their liver. And it's so important to them that some of them store it up for this winter hibernation.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
Well, I tell you the truth, I don't know too much about that. All I know is that, you know, some animals can manufacture their own vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
For example, rats, I believe, can manufacture their own vitamin C, and so probably some other rodents as well. But I guess one theory is that the vitamin C is an antioxidant, and so then if they're for a long time without oxygen, and then suddenly...
Introduce a lot of oxygen?
Introduce a lot of oxygen, it could be harmful.
Sure.
So that's when they need the antioxidants and potentially the vitamin C storage. They have a lot of it all at once.
Some of the food sources that the animals turn to are so interesting. And you've got a story about how we discovered how to get the maple sugar syrup sap from the maple trees. Tell us that story.
Well, I didn't know anything about it. I mean, I had often seen squirrels, you know, lapping on sap, and everybody presumed that, you know, squirrels like to drink sap. But I was watching squirrels, red squirrels, near my cabin. Actually, I was watching ravens at the time, but they weren't around too much, and so I was watching other things, and so there was squirrels out there, and I noticed that they would bite into the twigs and the limbs of sugar maples in March, basically still winter, but there are cold nights and kind of warmish days, gets above freezing, and they would bite in and just make a single pinch into the thin bark and then leave instead of staying there and sucking up sap, and it turned out that it takes quite a while for the sap to start running out, and then they would come back the next day or later, and by that time sap has run in a day or so, and it'll run down the trunk or the limb, and it'll evaporate. So sap is normally 98% water, and it's pretty hard to even taste any sugar there. There's plenty of snow, plenty of water around, so it didn't seem like they were just going for liquid. But it turned out they weren't really going that much for the liquid. They would wait till the sap evaporated, and then it would produce syrup and actually little gobs of sugar there, and then they would come and eat that sugar. And legend has it that, that the Iroquois discovered sugaring in this way. A little boy apparently was watching squirrels and noticing that red squirrels were eating the sap and then...
Harvesting the sugar out of the trees.
Yeah, and that's how they learned it.
So the Iroquois actually did. They would puncture just like we do and allow the sap to run and collect the syrup, and this was one of their food sources. And sugar, of course, highly desirable in the natural world because of the high calorie.
Yeah. Of course, they would speed up the evaporation process by putting it into vats and then throwing hot rocks in there and evaporating it. Mm-hmm. But if you only, after a little small quantity, you can just let it run down the limb and wait for it to evaporate. So yeah, food is an extremely important aspect of winter survival. And so the whole topic of food in the wintertime is a huge one, and all kinds of ingenious solutions. For example, many birds will store enough food for the whole winter. Pinyon jays and nutcrackers, for example, will hoard food in thousands of different little caches, and then remember exactly where they are and recover them.
This is the fuel through the winter. Heat yourself up and keep yourself going.
Right, yeah, because that's when fuel becomes most important, is in the wintertime, as anybody knows who wants to keep
the more
warm.
You burn,
have
the more
to
you
eat more candy
heat.
Bars and stuff, right. You need food. So you need all the more, and there's so much less available. So the food, so there's one way to, there are a couple of ways to do that. One is to reduce energy expenditure. The other is to expend more energy to find this food, and so it's a balancing act. And it, you know, which way it falls depends on what the environment has to offer and different possibilities.
You know, those indigenous societies that live so close to their environment, one of their survival mechanisms was to observe nature and the animals around them. And I'm intrigued by your going out into the woods and observing nature, and also taking students there on a yearly trek to do the same. Tell us about that program that you set up.
Well, as part of my teaching, I do teach a course called Winter Ecology. And we basically go to my cabin, which I built a log cabin up in Maine in the western mountains there, and I take a group of about a dozen students, and we kind of take walks every single day out in the woods and just see what we can find. A lot of things, you know, you can't just guarantee you're going to go out there and find a bear in hibernation or whatever, or even see a squirrel doing this. Or find any insects, because many animals are hidden. But you know, it's amazing how much more alive it makes everything to at least find some of these things, and then to talk about them from the real experience of actually having it in your hand, so to speak, rather than just reading about it in the book.
Or doing an experiment in a laboratory. Tell us how it's changed you as a scientist and added to your understanding of what you're studying to get out there onto their turf.
Well, I can't really envision doing it any other way. I mean, I've always gone to the field first and see something and wonder about it, and then watch it more closely, and then gradually seeing, you know, what kind of a seeing the problem that the organism faces, and then thinking about some of the solution, and then getting some preliminary observations, and then going to the lab, and then basically bringing it into the lab and looking at the details. I mean, many of these things you can't really study and to get at the mechanisms out in the field, but you can find the problems in the field and get some idea of what the solutions are, and then you find the details by close-in study.
Because you're studying the relationship of those animals to their environment, and so how can you divorce the environment entirely?
You can't, everything's related to the environment, so you have to kind of start from there, unless you're interested strictly in cellular mechanisms as isolated from everything else, but that's kind of rare. You really have to... If you're really interested in the animal, you have to start from the animal in the environment.
How do reptiles, I guess frogs would be amphibians, a little distinction there, but reptiles and so many insects depend on sunlight to warm them up in order to function. So how do they survive the extreme lack? You've described the moth earlier. How do snakes do it?
Well, again, these are reptiles survive. They don't store much food in the terms of fat and so on, or they don't lay up, you know, stores like a chipmunk does or anything like that. So the only way they can survive is by shutting down their metabolism to conserve the energy resources that they have, that they carry in their bodies. And the only way they can conserve them is to become very, very
Sluggish.
And cold. And they become sluggish by being cold. So when they want to be active and search, they heat themselves up.
They go sit in the sun, basically.
And so when they want to conserve what they've gotten, then they cool themselves down.
Oh, I see. So they go seek the shade.
Right.
Then to go hang out.
And of course, in the winter, it's like an extremely long, very cold day, so to speak, and they have to be extremely cold to survive it.
So the cold actually is their friend.
Exactly, right.
The very temperature becomes the mechanism that activates them to survive.
Right.
Oh, it's just so beautifully adapted,
so,
isn't it?
In fact, in Europe, I read in a paper some years ago about a couple of winters were too warm, and a lot of insects didn't make it because it was too warm, because they ran out of their energy reserves.
Oh, how interesting.
Presumably the reptiles and amphibians would have the same problem.
Insulation, by snow, if you could explain that, how some animals use the snow as insulation to keep their dens at a certain temperature, but also if you burrow down deep enough into the earth, doesn't the earth itself provide an even temperature? 55 degrees if you go deep enough, that's pretty even. But that wouldn't serve them to slow down their metabolism to survive it. So how does that work? What's that relationship there then?
Well, usually if there's a good snow cover right at the interface between the snow and the ground, it's near 0 degrees. It's near the freezing point.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to avoid being frozen, you can stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also potentially stay active because it's never going to get down to minus 30 or minus 40 degrees. So it's insulated from the external air. And many mice, for example, and shrews and moles and voles and they live in what's called the subnivian zone underneath the layer of snow.
Mm-hmm.
And they live there quite happily throughout the winter, and they're protected. And of course, many animals use the snow for overnight shelter. Grouse here in the northeast, for example, will dive into the snow and use snow shelters just the way as, the same way as some people can if they're caught out in a snowstorm. And the Eskimos, you dive into the snow, make a snow house.
You know how Eskimos are said they can eat the blubber and the meat, and, they're not a lot of vegetable source up in the Arctic.
Uh-huh.
Does their physiology change to accommodate? I mean, how far does the basic human physiology change to adapt to an environment?
Well, certainly our metabolism alters with respect to our diet, and it does. Lots of studies have been done with birds, for example. When they go on, when they change their diet, actually their gut length will even change.
Really?
To accommodate mm-hmm. different types of diet. If they have protein, fat diet, for example, their gut becomes smaller. If they have a more carbohydrate diet, their gut lengthens to allow for better absorption because it has, let's see, if there's more bulk, there's less...
And more cellulose to break down. And
more cellulose, and it takes longer, and there are less nutrients to be quickly absorbed, so it requires more surface area to get the same amount of energy.
Hmm.
So they actually change their gut length, and the same thing happens in some reptiles, and there are also micro changes with respect to the gut walls, for example, that allow for rapid absorption, or less absorption.
Does that happen in a generation, in an individual, or does it take several?
It happens in a matter of days or weeks.
Really? Oh, the body's that adaptable?
Right.
Wow. I thought it was just microbes that could, change on a dime because their lifespans and their generation process was so quick to respond to that.
Microbes.
Have you looked into the microbes, too, and how they...
No, I haven't, no.
Hmm. Do bears, for example, polar bears seem to be active all winter. Is that true? Because that's one of their prime... I mean, they know how to hunt, go to the edge of the sea and catch those seals and stuff?
They need the ice because they hunt from the top of the ice.
Mm-hmm.
And when the ice goes, they're in trouble. I mean, they can't hunt seals anymore because they wait for seals at the blowholes, and catch them there. But if they're out there swimming out in the open ocean, they're not going to catch a seal very well.
No. So, also, their sense of smell allows them, you know, to go a mile away and jump through the ice and find where the little baby seal has his little nest, right?
Right? They extremely have good sense of smell to locate. But, you know, yeah, so winter is...
prime hunting grounds for
them. Prime hunting grounds for some. And
so they don't hibernate, polar bears?
Not that I know of.
I've also read somewhere where their guard hairs act as solar insulators because there's a lot of sun shining on the Arctic during the day, I guess. And their guard hairs actually take some of the heat from the sun and warm their skin. I mean, just amazing adaptations.
Well, yeah, I've heard that they're sort of like optic fibers that,
that
reflect the light and carry it down. But at the same time, they act as insulation for reducing heat loss from the body. So that's a pretty neat adaptation.
Yep. The bears that hibernate, if you take an individual out, for example, and give it a life, you know, in the movies or training or in circuses or whatever, I don't know if they choose hibernating bears among those, but do those bears need a season of hibernation to keep their physiology in top shape, similar to, I don't know, apple trees that actually need ice and snow in order to complete their cycle and produce apples the next season?
That's a very good question. Certainly some animals, if they don't experience winter, they don't know it's time to get up yet. I mean, there's some moths, for example, that that require cold, a certain period of cold, before they will be active in the spring, the same as many bulbs in the garden.
Oh, right, yeah.
They need to be, so you need to chill them in the freezer if you're in the refrigerator at certain temperatures, depends on the species, what temperatures and how long. But with respect to bear, I'm not certain if anyone has really.
I was just using that as an example.
The principle applies, but you know, many animals have facultative hibernation.
What is facultative hibernation?
Facultative means, you know, depending on conditions. Mm-hmm. Certainly, the black bears around here if there's lots of food available, they will long delay hibernation. Potentially, if there's unlimited amounts of food, maybe they won't go into hibernation at all. That's facultative. And as opposed to obligatory, where if you put them under constant conditions, they'll automatically go into hibernation no matter what the temperature, no matter what the photo period. And there's some ground squirrels, for example, which if you put them in a constant temperature in a room, constant light, and they'll still go into hibernation.
Interesting.
In synchrony with the external season, as though they know what it is, even though they experience constant conditions. So that's obligatory. Well, and they have internal clocks that basically tell them when winter...
should be, even if it's not.
Should be, right.
Well, you know, given the climate cyclical, the cyclical nature of our climate, I would think that animals would want to have the facultative hibernation to adapt because we're in the interstitial period between glaciation periods.
Right.
So our climate does change radically over many hundreds of years, thousands of years.
Well, yeah, that's where you basically find facultative hibernation is in areas where there is much more fluctuation in the environment, the high Arctic, where it's always cold. I would expect you would have obligatory. I mean, they automatically prepare for hibernation even before it really gets cold. They have, when it's obligatory, you can prepare for it and store food or store fat. It takes a long time to get ready for the cold. But, you know, if it only happens once in a while and you have food available, it's better to hesitate and be flexible.
I bet another observation you have made by watching the animals out there in their natural environment is just how intelligent they are. And I know that you've made quite a study of ravens. Ravens are Paul's, my husband's, favorite birds. Uh-huh. And I look forward to a conversation with you about that aspect of your work. Can you tell us just a minute or two and conclude with what we'll be talking with you about at a future date, ravens. And
sure, that'd be great. Yeah, I've been studying ravens for a long time, and maybe I should start from overwintering. The fact is that, in the wintertime, they rely mostly on animals, on large carcasses, although in the summertime they can, you know, eat birds' eggs and catch grasshoppers and eat fruit and everything else. But in the wintertime, they rely mostly on large carcasses, and it turns out that that at carcasses, there are often large crowds form, and so I was interested how it was that, large crowds would form, even though ravens are generally thought to be territorial, fiercely territorial birds who don't allow any other birds near. And it looked to me like they were cooperating and bringing others in. And why they would be doing that, I was interested in that.
Yeah.
And then that related to potential solutions to behavioral solutions to food-finding problems. And then they have the problem of very often being in close association with carnivores, such as wolves, and they don't get eaten. How is it possible that they can exist alongside wolves and not get caught and eaten? And, and you know, of course, ravens have generally been thought to be the brains of the bird world, and nobody had any real concrete evidence. How do you know that they're smart? And so I've just been kind of going from one problem to another because they're so fascinating, and every set of observations kind of leads to another problem. And right now, you know, what they know and how they know it is one of the things that's been interesting me.
And that special relationship that they have with wolves, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All that at a future conversation. In the meantime, you can also read Bernd Heinrich's book, The Mind of the Raven, in addition to Winter World. Thank you so much for all the work that you do and sharing it with us today.
Well,
fascinating
you,
studies. And animals have a friend in you to help us all understand them better. So thank you so much. These are fascinating, wonderfully written books. And we all need to connect with the web of life around us and understand it better and appreciate it. And this is a very good addition to that quest, Winter World and the Mind of a Raven, and all of Bernd Heinrich's books. And thank you for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.